T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6,
E is equal to mc squared, in which energy is
all equal for man.
The human genome is our shared inheritance.
Cracks and cracks.
Hi, I'm Bob McDonald. The nuclear crisis in Japan this past week has certainly reignited the debate over nuclear power worldwide. China, the world's largest builder of nuclear reactors, has put its ambitious plans on hold for a while, while Germany is temporarily shutting down its seven oldest reactors and considering closing more. But at the same time, physicists and engineers are pointing to the next generation of reactors as safer, more robust, and more secure in a disaster situation. We'll examine those claims in a moment with a Canadian nuclear safety expert. Plus, we'll hear the remarkable story of the man who can't keep a beat. We'll learn how a South African orchid attracts insects by imitating the smell of rotting flesh. We'll discover the surprising fact that the ozone layer is still a problem, particularly over Canada's Arctic, and we'll find out how a tiny moth can keep up with a migrating bird. But first, can nuclear power be safe? This is Quirks and Quarks. There's no question that the nuclear crisis in Japan this past week has made a tragic natural disaster even worse. But the risks inherent in nuclear power demand that even in the worst-case scenario, the systems must be robust. We need them not to fail. Unfortunately, at the Fukushima Daiichi reactors, some of the systems have failed, and we still don't know the consequences. So in the wake of this disaster, a question we need to understand is whether nuclear power can be safe. Can we build systems that are robust enough to withstand the worst possible scenario? And how about the Canadian design CANDU reactors that we use in this country? Do they have safer controls than the Japanese reactors? And what about the so-called next generation reactors that are still in the design stage? To discuss this, I'm joined by nuclear safety researcher Dr. Dave Novog, director of the Institute for Energy Studies at McMaster University. Dr. Novog, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, we have a whole lot to discuss here, but let's begin with your reaction to what's been happening in Japan. Are you surprised by how this crisis has developed?
I think going back to the initial events from last Friday, the 9.0 earthquake and the tsunami, I expected there to be significant damage to the infrastructure in and around the plant. I expect that the emergency power systems would be available after a period of time, and I would expect that the reactors went into a shutdown state. Now, part of this, actually all of this, was achieved initially at the time of the earthquake, and the safety systems succeeded in shutting down the reactors at the site, and the emergency power systems did start up. About an hour after the initial earthquake, the tsunami hit the area and overcome the seawall protection system at the nuclear plant. And the subsequent damage to the infrastructure around the site, the emergency power system, the electrical grid, caused them to lose power.
You mentioned that the first thing that happened was the shutdown.
Yes.
Just take me through that. What happened?
So upon detection of an earthquake, there's various sensitive instruments within the reactor systems themselves, and the reactors are designed to very quickly terminate the fission process within the core upon detection of a severe event like an earthquake. So all the reactors in the region that were close to the tsunami's epicenter, or the earthquake's epicenter, initiated fast shutdown and were shut down within a few seconds. This is a fundamental part of the safety features that are built into reactors, is to detect early on situations like the earthquake. Not just earthquakes, but other things, other natural events that occur, and shut down the reactors as soon as possible.
Well, how do you do that? How do you actually shut down the reaction?
There's different methods used in the different designs around the world. One method would be to use control rods, which are inserted into the core. And what these do is these are control rods that very quickly gobble up all the neutrons within the core. And neutrons are small particles that are given off during a fission reaction and also cause other fission reactions. So it's a key part of sustaining a chain reaction. By injecting these rods in the core, we remove the neutrons, and hence we stop all the fissions from taking place. So in Canada, most people won't be aware, the shutdown system that relies on control rods in our CANDU reactors is completely passive. In the event of a loss of electricity or any loss of power, our control rods are actually held above the reactor core by electromagnets. And therefore, anytime they lose power, the electromagnets will stop working and the control rods will simply fall by gravitational forces into the reactor core. In fact, anytime we have a blip in the electrical supply whatsoever, even if it's not a result of an accident, these rods will disengage and fall by gravity into the reactor core and stop the fission process. So this is an example of a passive shutdown feature that doesn't require any electrical system in order to operate. In Canada, we also use an injection of a chemical substance, mostly gadolinium, into the reactor core. And gadolinium is also a very strong neutron absorber. We have on site some high-pressure nitrogen containers that are continuously pressurized. And this pressure is forced on the gadolinium solution and held back from the reactor core by some valve. So these valves are actually held closed by an electromagnet. And so on a loss of power, the electromagnets would open, and again, the shutdown system would activate. So both shutdown systems involved are completely power independent. They would work and function given a complete loss of power and backup power and emergency power.
So you're saying that we have to work to prevent the reactors from shutting themselves down.
Yeah, in essence, these are poised to shut down, and the thing that's keeping the reactor operating is the availability of electricity from the outside.
How does the shutdown system at Fukushima compare to the more modern designs?
I have to admit, I'm not 100% familiar with the exact shutdown systems. I do know that their shutdown systems activated. They activated within seconds of the event, and the reactors were very quickly brought down to just decay power levels. And really, it's that decay power level that became the issue later on. Even after we shut down nuclear reactors, we have a period of time where we need to sustain cooling. Even though the reaction is shut down, the residual heat and the residual radiation in the core needs to be cooled. And for the immediate time after the event, there was some cooling for probably between 1 and 8 hours. And subsequently, all power was lost. And when cooling was not sustained, the fuel would gradually heat up in temperature and eventually would undergo some damage.
So you're saying it's not the fission reaction itself that would normally be powering the reactor that's causing these things to heat up, because the reactor's been shut down.
Correct.
So what is that residual?
When isotopes of uranium undergo fission while the reactor's producing power, they break up into smaller elements. And these elements in themselves are very energetic. And so what you're talking is the byproducts of the fission reactions need to be cooled over a number of days in order to ensure that the fuel doesn't become damaged.
So how can this system be improved?
We have what's called active systems, and we have what's called passive systems. So active systems require some actions or some electrical capability at the plant. An example of an action you might need to take would be to change a valve position or to change some breakers within the power station to switch in new power supplies. So this requires somebody to go out into the field and to take these actions. Another active system would be the diesel generators powering some circulation pumps to cool the residual heat within the core. An example of a passive system would be something that did not require any pumping power. It wouldn't require electricity or the operators to do anything in the short or even the medium term. There are systems available, and in some of the reactor designs today, which use the heat within the core to warm up the coolant surrounding it. And as that coolant warms up, just like hot air, this hot water wants to rise. And as the hot water rises, it can be passed through a cooling pool and the water cools off. Now, cold water is not buoyant and it would want to fall back down into the reactor core. So we would have a continuous cycle, a continuous loop of liquid being heated in the core, rising to a higher level, being cooled, and then this liquid would fall back down into the core to complete the cycle. So this would be an example of a completely passive system because it solely requires the natural properties of water being buoyant as it gets warm and gravity pulling the cold water back towards the reactor core.
So you don't need any pumps to pump the water around. It just goes around by convection.
Yeah. So we have this convective cell, this convective loop taking place.
Are there any reactors that use this passive cooling now?
In fact, our CANDU reactors here in Canada, have a form of passive cooling for exactly these types of events. For a period of time after a complete loss of power or a complete blackout and a failure of diesel generators, the CANDU reactors would go into a mode that we call natural circulation cooling.
How long can that operate?
It would depend on the nature of the incident we're looking at. In the long-term cooling, we would have a period of time of several days to put in place another source of water to fill up heat exchangers at the top of the power plant.
Wow, several days.
Yes.
There's another concept that I know you use called walk-away safety. What do you mean by that?
So a system, you can imagine if that same natural circulation system was able to reject heat just using air coolers to the environment. So this would just force some air from outside the building over top of the hot water in order to cool it off. And this kind of radiator, exactly like the radiator in your car, would radiate the energy in the form of heat out to the environment. And so if we had a system like this that didn't rely on water in any case, then we would be able to sustain this natural circulation flow for very, very long periods of time, almost indefinitely, without having to supply water or worry about makeup systems. And so this kind of walk-away safe concept is what researchers are looking at for the next generation of nuclear reactors.
How far away are we from that?
Well, I think the current reactors, as I mentioned, provide a substantially longer period of time than what we saw in Japan to be able to initiate some other forms of water. And they do employ natural circulation already. So from that respect, the operating CANDUs we have in Canada are a step ahead of a lot of reactor designs in the world. What we're looking at in Generation 3 and Generation 3 Plus, the new builds of reactors, are really substantially improving the amounts of time available before we require operator action.
One of the concerns in Japan right now is that if cooling fails, the fuel will melt and it will escape from the reactor vessel into the environment. Is there any way to design to deal with that kind of disaster?
The containment system, and you've heard it mentioned in Japan, is a robust structure of concrete and steel liners that's really designed to contain a vast majority of the radiation and the radioactive materials post any accident within that structure. I think at this time, the injection of seawater into the cores has stabilized the situation within the cores, and I don't believe, at least for the knowledge that I have, that there is any sign that the material has turned to liquid and melted through the containment structure. At least there's no visible signs and no signs of the radiation that would occur should that happen. Now, in the CANDU design, within the design itself, there's a massive structure of water located around the reactor core, and the goal of this water would be, in the event of all unforeseen circumstances, to keep the residual material in the cool core for a very long time. So one of the things we do when we're designing and planning nuclear materials is we go through what we call barrier analysis. We say, what's our first line of defense? What's our second line of defense? And so we continue to do this, and we employ more and more levels of defense into the design. And so one of those levels of defense that we've designed into a CANDU reactor is this large container of water which surrounds our reactor core. And the purpose of this would be to shield radiation as well as to confine any material that might melt within the core and keep it cool within the containment structure. And so the goal of having this pool of water and of all the defenses we put in place are specifically designed to prevent the occurrence of these types of temperatures that can lead to a steam explosion. And this includes the large vault of water, the separate moderator cooling system, the main heat transport system, the emergency cooling system, and the shutdown cooling systems within the core. So these are many defense in depth features of the core that we could put in place, backups upon backups, to ensure that we don't get this type of vapor explosion occurring.
Well, right now, one of the other concerns in Japan, besides what's going on in the core of the reactor, are the pools where the spent fuel is sitting, and this is fuel that's already been in the reactor. What can be done about that problem?
The fuel that comes out of the core during normal operations is radioactive and needs to be cooled for a period of time before it can safely be stored in a dry environment. So these spent fuel pools are very, very large and deep swimming pools, essentially, that are lined with steel in order to provide an extra layer of sealing to keep the water inside the structure. The seriousness of it is that as the fuel overheats, it may not melt because the fuel's been out of the core for a long period of time. The heat may not be sufficient to cause melting. And that's why I said that in units 1, 2, and 3, the heat loads are so high that they need to sustain cooling for a period of time to make sure that fuel doesn't get damaged. In the storage pools, while the heat may be lower, given exposure to air, the fuel would still overheat. And while this heating might not cause melting, it still could be sufficient to cause the protective sheaths around the fuel to fail. And if these fail, then the gases and the radioisotopes within the fuel could potentially escape. And because this fuel is not within the containment structure, it would be difficult to control this radioactive release unless you were able to get water back around the fuel and keep it cool again. And I think going forward, we need to make sure that the designs are such that the pools are secured or safe from any type of chance of an explosion that can damage their structure.
We see so few of these large nuclear disasters. What can we learn from Fukushima?
I think we'll be able to tell that much better in the days and weeks to come. I think certainly there will be a review of post-accident cooling to make sure that all the lessons we learn and all the things that we can and cannot anticipate are factored into the designs and into the operations. And I think if we do learn anything that causes us to require changes to the backup power systems or the emergency power systems, it would be important for us to look at how we incorporate those into the designs.
Perhaps there's another lesson from nature that no matter how much we try to predict what could happen, it always seems to trump us in some other way.
Yeah, I think this is true across all industries. It's important for us to plan for the worst, but also make even backup plans for something that we can't anticipate.
Dr. Novak, thank you very much.
Great, thanks. Anytime.
Dr. David Novog is Associate Chair in Nuclear Safety Analysis and Director of the Institute for Energy Studies at McMaster University. I'm Bob McDonald, and you're listening to Quirks and Quarks, the national science program heard every Saturday afternoon and Monday evening across Canada on CBC Radio 1. We're across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio 137, on various public radio stations throughout the U.S., and via our weekly podcast. Coming up, smells awful, but it works.